I'm Elaine Clark, managing editor for KUER News and former producer of Radio West. The late journalist Charles Bowden never shied away from the hard stuff. We had the chance to talk to him 7 times on Radio West. The last was in 2010, when his book about the crisis of poverty and violence in Ciudad Juarez first came out. He never blinked, and he never sugarcoated the truth. But the most important thing I learned from Bowden came in an email, some advice he gave me about journalism and writing. Here's what he said. Here are the two essentials, love and a willingness to fail. Without love, you cannot become other people and crawl inside their strange lives. And unless you are willing to fail, you choke before you begin and do safe and easy and limited and pointless things. After that, it's simply improvisation. August marks the 5th anniversary of Charles Bowden's death at the age of 69. Here's our conversation with him about his book, Murder City.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In his new book, the writer Charles Bowden recounts a conversation he had with one of the sicarios, one of the hired killers who murder for drug lords in the border towns of Mexico. He's laying out the ground rules for the interview with the man, and he explains that he's not there to solve crimes. "I'm here to explain how the world works," he says. Bowden is trying to understand what has changed in Juarez. In the book, he says there was a time when death made sense. You died because you lost a drug load or because you were a snitch. And he says there was a pleasant order to the death there. But now, the world has changed. And you get a sense reading the book, the change is more than just the exponential rise in murder and drug violence. Today in the program, Charles Bowden is joining us to talk about his book and his observations from 15 years now on the border. This is more than just a collapse of society, he says. It's a new way of life. His book is called Murder City. And we're talking about it. Charles Bowden is a writer, a reporter, author of many books, including Dreamland, The Way Out of Juarez. His work regularly appears in Harper's, GQ, and other national publications. But Charles Bowden, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, so I wanted to begin with, and I was sort of briefly mentioning it off air, but I have to say an epigraph that you include in the book that caught my eye. And it comes from Arthur Miller's Death of a Salesman. Linda Lohman, his wife, and her, it's this painful plea she makes to her sons about their father, the hapless salesman, Willie Lohman. And she says, attention must be paid to such a person. What was it about that?
Well, what struck me was you can't ignore things once you know they're happening. In less than 3 years, 5,000 people have been executed in Juarez. The American press has almost completely ignored it until 3 people affiliated with the U.S. consulate were murdered in March. The only reason I wrote this book was I became obsessed with trying to create a record of the slaughter. And the second thing that motivated me was I was seeing something I didn't understand, a city where the actual economy now has become death. There's a bumper crop in Juarez. It's never in the press. At least 10,000 new orphans, because their parents have been slaughtered. Last year, there were 2,753 murders. There were only 30 arrests. This is a way of life there now. And, of course, it's not my life, and it's not something I've ever seen before. Juarez is the most violent city in the world today. New York, 6 murders per 100,000 inhabitants. Juarez is 200. Baghdad is like a Quaker village compared to Juarez. So the book, I won't say it wrote itself. I didn't know I was writing a book.
Really?
I went back there in January of 2008 because it was a sudden spate of murders of police comandantes. And I didn't know what was going on because the state police there worked for the Juarez cartel, so why would you be abusing the help?
Yeah.
And that month, there were 44 people, as I recall, murdered. Now it's 200 a month. And it just keeps getting bigger. There's now 11,000 Mexican soldiers and federal agents in Juarez. And every time they send more of them, the murder rate goes up. The murder rate has no center. The city's dying. 25% of the houses have been abandoned. 100,000 jobs have been lost to the recession. 40% of the businesses have slammed shut. 30 to 60,000 wealthier Mexicans have fled to El Paso and bought homes. And what you have left are the people trapped by poverty, immigration laws, and they live under the gun. Look, I don't know how to make people wrap their heads around this because I barely can.
Yeah.
Yesterday, 22 people were executed. The day before that, 14 people were executed. To say you get numb doesn't capture it. The numbers just start to blur. It's a catastrophe, and it's not a catastrophe that descended from the heavens. It's explicable to a degree. For 40 years...
It's explicable?
Explicable. I can't spell it, but I just proved I can say it. Look at... For 40 years, Juarez has been a laboratory testing U.S. free trade policies. These policies have created a massive population drawn to the border. There's 400 factories there, like Electrolux, the vacuum cleaners. These factories pay a wage that no one can live on. The cost of living in Juarez is roughly 90% what it would cost to live in the United States. The wages are you work 5.5 days a week and you get $75. So that created a feral population. The turnover in these factories in a country with very little employment is 100 to 200% because people just can't do it. We've got two generations of kids that are raised without parents, meaning their parents are working in these slave factories. We now have 500 to 900 street gangs. And these aren't car clubs. These are young kids, armed and dangerous. 40% of the kids they surveyed in Chihuahua, the state Juarez is in, said when they grow up they want to be sicarios. 50% of the adolescents are neither in school nor do they have jobs. Then in December of 2006, the new president of Mexico assumed office, and as is a custom, he asserted that he was a strong man, that he could rule, and his tactic to convey this point was he unleashed the Mexican army against what he called the drug cartels. Since that moment, over 23,000 Mexicans have been slaughtered. Since that moment, this 250,000-man army that's allegedly fighting the evil drug cartels has lost 100 men. Since that moment, Mexico has slowly started to erupt. The violence is not just on the border. It's spreading throughout the country. There's killings every day all over the place. And I think what he did was a stunt. He ripped the mask off the problems of Mexico, and the problems are poverty. The problems are their biggest real export isn't drugs. It isn't oil. It's human beings. There's 10 to 15 million Mexican citizens now living in our country illegally, trying to make a living. This is the largest migration of human beings on earth that's going on now, and it's a flight of the poor from doom toward hope. It is not an issue of homeland security as we phrase it. Nobody's coming here to rob or kill you. They're coming here to mow your lawn or something. And I've interviewed lots of these people. They've never been 50 miles from their village before. They're just desperate. Well, in Juarez, it all comes to a head. Years ago, I wrote a book saying Juarez was a laboratory of our future. Well, Murder City's the lab report. Total breakdown.
It's interesting how much of this book is... which is not to say that your other books aren't personal, but this is, you get a sense that throughout the book that you are trying to figure out your own kind of reaction to it, what to make of it. You talk about moments when you sit and try to kind of understand it. And you never get a sense that even though it's explicable, as you say, as that you understand sort of the causes, you are lost about understanding it completely. Does that make sense?
Well, certainly. Look at it. I'm overwhelmed.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know how to deal with 22 people being murdered in one day. I would spend days sometimes going from one killing to the next with my little notebook with my friend Julian Cardona, who was taking photos. And it just becomes a blur. That there's things people have to think about that are apparently unspeakable. Our free trade policy has been tested in Juarez for 40 years. It's produced cheap goods for us and total misery for the people that make them. Our war on drugs officially began with President Richard Nixon. We're 40 years in. It's a total failure. There are more drugs everywhere in this country than there were when we started. We have the highest prison population on earth per capita. All the drugs are cheaper, higher quality. That we have tried to police our population, to control what they consume, and it hasn't worked. What we've done is essentially fight a war against our own people who, for various reasons, want to take substances to alter their consciousness. And if we continue down this path, I suppose someday drugs will be free because they keep getting cheaper. If we continue down this path, I guess they'll be in more places. I did a story about 2 or 3 years ago for National Geographic on Western North Dakota, which is about as bucolic as you get. There's hardly anybody there. I'm in a county of maybe 15,000 people. In 1 year, the sheriff in that county busted 80 meth labs. So that this is a war that can't be won. Now, the war has its own momentum. There's a built-in establishment of police officers, prison guards, therapists that are committed to the war because that's how they make their money. But the byproduct, in I guess 27 months, is 23,000 dead Mexicans. And they didn't fall over from cardiacs. These are terrible crimes. There's one case I covered where the police commander and his 8-year-old boy, and they pumped 250 rounds into the truck cab when they killed him. We're getting people, wars is being littered with bodies that have been decapitated or they cut your arms off, and I won't go any further. There's no way to characterize these people. The Mexican government says they're all dirty. That's a lie. But at least 90% of these people are just poor people. I mean, they're not capos. They don't drive limousines. They don't have gold chains. They live day to day. It's a general slaughterhouse. And whereas if you're murdered, almost certainly the person who kills you will not be punished. But you'll probably die and never know why you were killed. You'll just catch a barrage. It could be something petty, some little thing that escaped your notion. They killed a tamale vendor there a couple months ago and his woman. They stood out on the street with a little cart and sold tamales. They executed him at 9:30 in the morning. It's because he'd missed his protection payment to some little gang of thugs. He had to pay them $10 a week, and he didn't have it. So they just walked up and blew both their brains out. You know, this isn't a drug war. This is something we lack language for, and we refuse to look at. This is a failing society. And part of what's causing it to fail is us. I mean, the violence in drugs is because we like drugs. The violence in these barrios is because these factory jobs cannot sustain a human being. That's it. I'll be calm now.
Well, it's interesting. You talk about there's this. There are a number of kind of themes. I don't know if you regard them as sort of symbols, but throughout there's one I wanted to ask you about, this woman, Miss Sinaloa. You talk about her as a woman you weren't looking for, hadn't heard of her, and then all of a sudden you say she appeared in your life, and you can still remember the moment. It was a bright winter day in the desert.
Yeah, what Miss Sinaloa is a beauty queen. Sinaloa is a state. They grow beauty queens there like mushrooms. They have a pageant all the time. Yeah. And it's because the drug guys finance them and then their girlfriends win. She came to Juarez for a party. It's quite common, to fly in beautiful women if you have money. It's for entertainment. But instead of a fiesta, she was raped for 3 days by the police. And she lost her mind. And she was brought to an asylum that's run by a friend of mine, El Pastor Galban, and slowly recovered her mind. But I stumble on the asylum, and everybody's talking about this beautiful woman that used to be there. And she got into the book because I thought, she says what the city does to people. It doesn't matter who you are. It doesn't matter your class. It doesn't matter if you're a beautiful woman or an average-looking guy. The city destroys you and will eventually kill you. The city is now a death machine. So she's one of the guys. One of the other people that wanders throughout the book is a professional killer I know, a sicario. He's probably killed 500 or 600 people. And then there's a reporter, Emilio Gutierrez, who's now seeking political asylum in the United States because the Mexican army tried to kill him. The same Mexican army we give $500 million a year to finance their heroic war on drugs. And so I use them like keys on a piano to play the funeral march of Juarez as it totters toward an abyss.
You say this, you say you talk about how you've come to this city for 15 years now. And like everyone here, you say you have an investment in the dead and in the living. How do you, Charles, explain your relationship to the place? El Pastor says he loves the place.
I can't say that. I'm trapped in it.
Yeah.
I hope I never am in Juarez again, and I know I will be. Frankly, like I got an emergency call from El Pastor this morning because there's no health care in Juarez. There's no nothing. He's got 150, 120 damaged people who are never coming back. They have to eat. And there's no money, so I sent him some money. But the attraction is something's going on in Juarez. It's larger than Juarez. Something's going on in Juarez that's not recorded in the U.S. press that should be. A modern city based on all our principles of industry and trade is collapsing. And it's not just a little recession. It's collapsing into violence. It's killing itself. And I want to write it down. On the other hand, I'd just as soon be in some place that was happier. If the mainstream press ever descends on Juarez, I'll feel I can leave.
Yeah.
But it's like that quote you read by Arthur Miller from Death of a Salesman. I've believed that since I was a 15-year-old boy and first read the play, that you can't turn your back on things. You can't say, well, there's nothing I can do about it, which is always a lie. You can do something. You can help a person. And because I write, let's assume I have some talent. I think I should use it for things like that, to make people aware of Juarez. We have enough people writing poems about trees. They can take care of that turf. I want to make people face what's happening now. I want people to face that there's a reason Mexicans are coming north, and it's because their world's collapsing, and a wall won't fix it. 20,000 Border Patrol agents won't fix it. The law the governor of my state, Arizona, just passed, demonizing Mexicans, won't fix it. That I live in a country full of churches. Well, I know what the churches teach you, and they teach you to help other people. Well, here's your chance to step up to the plate and act out on your religious beliefs.
Charles Bowden. He's the author of Murder City, Ciudad Juarez in the Global Economy's New Killing Field. He's also the author of the book Dreamland, The Way Out of Juarez. We're going to take a brief break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER.
Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. A lot of people want to know, does Doug really read all those books? The answer, yeah, he does. No one really knows how, but we do know that he gets up very early. If you want to try keeping up with him, you can buy the book by clicking on the indie bookstores, Amazon, or Audible links at the bottom of the episode page. If you do, some of the proceeds go to support Radio West. So thanks for that, and thanks for listening. Here's the show.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the writer and journalist Charles Bowden. We're talking about his new book, Murder City, Ciudad Juarez in the Global Economy's New Killing Fields. It's interesting, Charles, how much time, and you mentioned this in the book, how much waiting has played a part in your life, waiting in motel rooms, you say, in cafes, in parking lots, in street corners. And that comes into play as you wait for the Sicario. And which you describe as that you had been waiting years and years for this meeting. Talk about that.
Well, Sicario's a contract killer working for organized crime. And that often means he's employed by the police or the army. They all have their own Sicarios. And I've been around these guys for 20 years. You know, you sort of know that guy down there at that table is a killer. But they won't talk, you know, because they have enough problems. Talking is fatal. And so this guy, finally I got one to talk. And We talked a long, long time. He'd been in the life for 20 years. He was a state police commandant. He's probably killed 500 people. We won't even count the kidnappings and torture. And I told him what I wanted, and he gave it to me. Tell me how the world works.
You describe in the book, and I want to have you read this section, you say, I must have him. What do you mean by that? I must have him.
I'm a writer. I'm not a journalist or any of these big words. That what I do is I go witness things, and I bring them back for other people. And I wanted, in this world of violence, one of the practitioners to finally go on the record. You know, how it operates and how it feels and how it comes to pass. That's it. That's why I must have him. No magazine wanted to publish it. I won't give it sorry history. It was eventually published in Harper's. But they were horrified by the piece. The piece I'd waited 20 years to do. And it's because I think people, there's a part of people that doesn't want to know the truth. These 23,000 people that died in Juarez weren't hit by meteors. I mean, the 23,000 in Mexico. They're killed by guys like this, a lot of them. That's why I wanted it. The same reason reporters want to interview Osama bin Laden. Like, who is this person who's trying to kill us? You know, what does he think? But I am not a killer. I've been rather, I have survived covering the Juarez's for a simple tactic. I'm a coward. The cemetery is full of brave reporters. I want to be a living reporter for a while.
But, read this section if you would.
Sure. I've been with mountain lions, twice less than 10 feet away. Once with a lion standing in the night, screaming in my face. I consider them fellow citizens, not predators. The basic American lion kills about once a week, depending on the temperature and how long the meat holds. Kills something in the range of 75 to 100 pounds. Their dreams are based on white-tailed deer. After the kill, which is quick in order to reduce the chance of injury, they stay on the carcass until it is gone or goes bad. It is not a business. I have no idea how they feel about the killing, but it has to be personal, since they kill with their mouths, inhaling the scent of the victim, feeling the warm blood flood their tongue as life leaves the body. I've been with rattlesnakes and often sat a few feet away as they rested in a coil. Their habits vary with the species and the opportunities of the ground, but the ones I've spent the most time with only killed about 2 rats a year. Think of them as armless Buddhas. They are hardly creatures up for duct tape and torture, and they ask for no money for their killings. The foxes, coyotes, and weasels of my life have all been lesser events, but all, in balance, quite civil in their behavior and not prone to boasting or excess. I feel no fear, no rancor toward them, not even the coyotes that rip the throat out of a favored dog. But the man I am waiting for, he hails from a different country, and his tribe is known to me only as a rumor and legend, and briefly flickers out of the corner of my eye. I have sat with the cold men, pistols in their waistbands, and know I was not like them, but I have never known just what they were like. That's why I've come here. That's why I wait. That is why the phone rings, the voice says it'll take a little longer, and that is why the man does not come. It will take time, days perhaps. I think it is possible. And I think it is possible because I have come, and he's not used to that. Because he can see his own death, smell it as near, and he knows he will soon be forgotten because nobody really wants to remember him. And then we wound up talking for a week or two.
It's interesting you'd write about the flow of it. At first, it's interesting. It seems a little unsteady at first. You talk about you were trying to it's like you were trying to get the sense of each other. You say that he says nothing is to leave this room, but then you're taking all of these notes.
Yes.
You say you can never repeat what he tells you, even though you say, all right, I will never repeat this, even though you tell him you will repeat it. I mean, it was kind of a dance at first.
Well, he knows he's going to die. There's a $250,000 contract on his life. He has to move constantly. At this moment, it could take me days to locate him. if I could. And like all human beings, in my experience, people are looking for someone they can tell the truth to that won't turn their back on them. They all want to purge themselves of the way they've lived. So that was what I gave him. It was an interesting conversation. At one point, I asked him how much he charged to kill me, since he's a professional contract killer. He said the maximum would be $5,000, but it'd probably be much less because I had no power, and if he killed me, nobody'd come after him because I don't matter. So I'm a bargain. And, you know, I have to tell your listeners, I grew to like him. In a perfect world, I would spend days with him and then come out of the room and say, well, he's a psychopath.
Yeah.
But I don't think he's a psychopath at all. He's a perfectly normal human being. One of the hardest lessons in life is that terrible things are done by people that are essentially normal. That's where the Holocaust, everything comes from. It's not from some monster. That Mexico has produced thousands of men like this man who are killing. And they all go home to families, and they're all fairly normal people. He certainly is. And he's lethal. I mean, he's state of the art. Incidentally, part of his training was by the U.S. FBI.
Yeah.
You know, something we don't like to think about. There's a terrorist group in Mexico now called the Zetas, and they were trained by the U.S. military. They were supposed to fight drugs. Well, they looked at the wage scales and decided they were on the wrong team. I should imagine, not to get too sidetracked, but this army of 250,000 men the Mexicans are using to fight the drug world has had 150,000 desertions in 6 years. And almost certainly everybody that deserted left to join the drug industry because you get to kill people there and they pay you better. This is kind of a hopeless cause. Well, it's not even a cause. There has been no interruption in drug shipments by this three-year initiative of the Mexican army. There is no one listening to this that suddenly has noticed a panic in their city or town because there are no drugs. Whatever this is about, it's not touching the business.
It's interesting you talk about how the Mexican government and the DEA says the violence and war is because of these drug cartel battles, which you say makes perfect sense, except you say the war fails to kill cartel members.
That's right. I mean, Vicente Carrillo runs a Juarez cartel. He lives in a mansion in Juarez, and any cop in the city can drive up there if they want to have a chat with him. I mean, this is malarkey. Mexico can't shut down the drug industry. Mexico's budget, federal budget, comes from oil. 40% of the federal budget is oil. The oil fields are dying. The Mexican government has announced they'll be exhausted in 9 years. Their second largest licit source of money are the people they exported to the United States. We call this remittances. Some guy you see working in the kitchen of the cafe where you had breakfast this morning is sending checks home to feed his family in Mexico. That's $20 to $25 billion a year. DEA's analysts figure the drug industry in Mexico earns them in foreign currency $30 to $50 billion a year. So to actually ask them to, quote, shut this down would be asking them to commit economic suicide. It isn't going to happen. The second thing you have to understand is with that kind of cash flow, there isn't a police force in Mexico that isn't compromised by drug money. There isn't a significant politician who doesn't take drug money. Frankly, you can't breathe without taking drug money. I mean, El Pastor Galban is taking care of 120 brain-damaged people who will never recover in a city where there's no care. He picks them off the street, literally. They're just, you know, living on the street. And some of his money comes from drug members, meaning people in the life know they're going to die, and they know they're going to face God, and they want to do something to sort of even out the score. This is quite common, that you cannot be, by American standards, clean in Mexico unless you're a corpse. It's everywhere. There are probably 300,000 to 400,000 people in the city of Juarez partly dependent on the income of the drug industry. There's tens of thousands of them working in it. Any given day, there's 15 tons of cocaine warehoused in Juarez. So whatever's going on is in that. What has happened is our war on drugs, our Plan Morita, where we give $500 million a year to the army, is now a war of the Mexican army against the Mexican poor. and they're getting killed. The government says 90% of the corpses are people that are dirty. That isn't true at all. You go down to the morgue, 90% of the corpses are just poor people, nobodies, just people that live in shacks. You know? This is a myth both governments have to have, that they're fighting the righteous war.
I wanted to ask you more about Emilio Gutierrez Soto. As you put it in the book, dead reporter driving. A reporter who covered a
sensation. That's accurate, I mean.
That's the question. I mean, it's interesting because you say he may die because he wrote a story, a simple, accurate story, but he thought it was his duty. Talk about this reporter.
Well, he's a poor guy raised in northern Chihuahua who became a reporter. He's a rare Mexican, and he made it through high school. High schools are not free in Mexico. You have to pay to go. Like in Juarez, there's a high school for every 500,000 residents. That's why these kids aren't in school. They can't afford the books. So he was successful. He's a single father raising a son. That's his whole life. He's clean. Once he had the boy to raise, he just changed his life. He never got associated with anything bad. He didn't take bribes, which a lot of reporters do. He lived on his wages, which were not high. He writes a small story about an incident with the Mexican army where some soldiers robbed a cafe, the customers, and stole their food. This is quite common because they forget to feed their soldiers. Thought now they know of it, and the Mexican army came to kill him. He then had researched.
Now, we need to say, about the army.
Yes, the army, the one we're paying for. They came. The general came. The officers. They were going to kill him. He escapes to the U.S., takes his boy with him. When he enters the port of entry, when you enter the United States, customs always ask you, what are you bringing? Meaning, you know, are you bringing bananas or I bought a purse? He said, we bring fear. He came here because he thought this was a country that respected human rights. He came here because even though he toyed with, you know, facing death, he wasn't going to let his son get hurt. Our response when he asked for political asylum was we put him in prison for 7 months and his son in prison for 2 months. They're now out and the case is pending. But Emilio Gutierrez presents a problem for the American government and the American people. We have never granted political asylum to a Mexican reporter because then the U.S. government would have to admit what Mexico's really like. But his case is almost bomb-proof. Inadvertently, they videotaped him and interrogated him. Inadvertently, since he doesn't know our laws, everything he said fits our exact definition of a person who should get political asylum. Now, he's now living in the U.S. He's got a little job, a little car. His boy is in a U.S. high school. Emilio's going to night classes to learn English. He's a hard-working guy, and he would go back to Mexico tomorrow if they didn't kill him, but he can never go back. So he's going to be one of our citizens one day. But he wasn't a rabble-rouser. There is no security. He just offended a general, the general in charge of the whole state. And that was the end of him. Nobody could protect him. He got a warning. They're hunting for you. They ransacked his house. That's why he fled north and brought fear. You know, and he's an unimpeachable witness. I mean, he's, you know. And he's a nice guy. You know, I've tried to help him. But look, it's the luck of the draw. I can sit here in this studio and say anything I want. You know, I can say the president of Mexico is a crook or whatever. You do that in Juarez and you'll die. Stories in the paper increasingly have no bylines because the book's dedicated to a reporter in Juarez, murdered November 13, 2008, at 8:30 in the morning as he warmed up his car with his 8-year-old girl beside him in the front seat to take her to school. They just walked up and executed him. The case has never been solved. Well, there are no cases solved there. He had filed 907 murder stories that year before he was killed. So I dedicated the book to him because, look, I'm taking no risk. I'm a U.S. citizen. Killing me causes trouble. But the Mexican reporters are doing a far better job of trying to get these deaths recorded in the paper, and they take a big risk. It's the most dangerous country in the world now to be a reporter. It has the highest number of reporters killed or disappeared. So they're the heroes. I'm just a guy who carries the water.
Let's take a call. John has been waiting. He's in Sacramento, California. John, forgive me for the wait. Welcome.
That's all right. Thank you.
Sure.
I turned this on kind of midstream, so you may have already addressed this, but I work for a company that I'd rather remain nameless about that has a maquiladora manufacturing facility in Ciudad Juarez. We also have them in a couple of other cities. And I'm wondering what the situation is like for an employee of ours, an American company, who works there, a Mexican national who works for us. Is he safer, less safe? How do they get by? What are we doing? I don't know what we're doing. We must be paying protection, I guess, huh?
Well, I can't speak to your exact firm, but if
right.
The management's usually U.S., it commutes.
Right.
And the chances of being kidnapped have gone up astronomically. It's increasingly dangerous. The workers get robbed and killed. They're in increasing danger. There is no order in the city anymore. The mayor of Juarez actually lives in El Paso. He doesn't like to admit that. The publisher of the daily paper actually lives in El Paso. And I'll tell you something that is new and novel, which may give you some idea of the jeopardy. Members of the cartel increasingly are buying houses in El Paso and commuting to Juarez to kill people because they don't think it's a safe place to live. We're getting literally a narco community in El Paso. It's not breaking laws or causing trouble in El Paso. El Paso has almost no crime. And then they get up in the morning, and just like the people in your factory that manage it, they drive across the bridge to go to work, and their work is murder. So I hope that's the best I can do to, you know, give you some context.
John, glad you called. Thanks. Here's an email from Mark, who writes from Sugar House in Salt Lake City. Living in poverty at working for a wage that will never lift you out of poverty is financial slavery, he writes. Is there anything that an American can do to stop the cycle? Is there legislation that could change it?
Well, yes, there is something we can do. Look, I can't give you a solution that undoes instantly 40 years of policies, meaning the war on drugs and our trade policies. We should renegotiate NAFTA. And here's the terms. We should protect unions. These people should have the right to organize. We should insist these plants are not hell holes of chemicals, which they are. And we should demand a living wage. If you don't want Mexicans moving to Salt Lake City en masse, then you have to provide a wage so they can stay where they are. These people coming north, no offense to the fine people of Salt Lake, would just as soon stay in Mexico. They're coming here just to work. Now, the dirty little secret are these wages. You know, they skid over that whenever they praise their plants. These wages are slave wages. They produce misery. I'm sitting here wearing clothes, as is my custom. I don't think there's an item on my body made in the United States. Nor do I think it was made by anyone who was paid a living wage, because you can't find that anymore. We've exported our jobs. The rule of thumb is, if you move an American factory to Mexico, what you're paying per hour in the U.S. is what you will pay per day in Mexico. And so we've destroyed good jobs here, and we haven't created viable jobs there. What we've created are cheap products, which you and I all consume. I would like to, when you go into a Walmart or a big American store, you shouldn't look at the prices. You should look at the floor because you're walking across a sea of blood. That's what's producing these products. And we got clothing now made by 10, 12-year-olds in Bangladesh and that. Disney was getting all their stuff in the Disney shops made there. Now, we have to insist, one, that no product enters the United States that's made by a child, you know. And two, that we don't want things in our store where the people making them don't make a living wage. They don't have to be paid the same as somebody in Salt Lake City, but they ought to make enough money to feed and clothe themselves and house themselves. And they're not now. The second thing is the war on drugs. The war on drugs is lost. It's 40 years old. Drugs are cheaper than they've ever been, more abundant. Whatever the attitude Americans have toward drugs, they have to know absolutely that using the police to solve it has been a disaster. And so we've taken a public health issue and sent in the cops, and it hasn't worked. And to persist in this policy is idiocy. We're imprisoning our fellow citizens simply because they want to ingest things that some of us don't approve of. We can still disapprove of people taking drugs, but we certainly are not going to stop them with police. We all know that just walking around our towns and cities.
I wanted to ask you a bit more about your conversation with the contract killer, with the Sicario. It's interesting. The interplay at the beginning, he puts you in a chokehold.
Yes.
Were you ever frightened?
Yes and no. I mean, realistically, I'm always afraid. Yeah. But no, when I'm doing a story, all I think about is how to get the story. Yeah. And so, no, I wasn't. But he's a menacing person. I mean, he's highly skilled. I mean, this guy is a trained killer, like a Rambo. I mean, he's demonstrated many things to me. Like once he showed me how he garrote me, he took a piece of string and made a garrote. And I was very convinced.
Speaking briefly off the air there, you were saying that there is a point at which his whole persona was built around not trusting people.
Yes.
Because, as you said, everyone that had trusted him ended up dead.
That's correct. He actually knows where 600 people are secretly buried in various places in Mexico. And the reason he knows is he put them there. You know, they have these secret burying grounds. That's what Dreamland's about, yeah. This other book. Yes, so he knows what it's like to trust someone, because the people that trusted him thought they were going to have a meeting. He executed, you know, or he tortured. There were two DEA informants, you know, in Mexico that he tortured for 3 days. He had a doctor there to keep shooting them with adrenaline and drugs when they started to die, and he burned them alive slowly for 3 days. I don't want the people listening to this to think this is some nice guy. But what's chilling, as I said earlier, is he's a normal guy. I've learned this several times in my life, that you have to realize this barbarism is latent in all of us, and being a decent human being is suppressing it, controlling it, not giving in to it. He gave into it for 20 years. He was the head of the state police anti-kidnapping unit in Juarez. But, of course, he was the kidnapper, his squad. Yeah. They would kidnap somebody, and then the phone would ring, and somebody would say, you know, my husband's been kidnapped, and we'll be right on it. When they ever had the guy themselves for ransom, they usually killed them, so they couldn't complain afterwards. He told me that only 2% of the people he ever kidnapped came back alive.
You talk about, Chuck, this moment, this time where you both sort of sat in silence, and you say in some way you were trying to return to a time before you knew about all of this, before you knew about the killings, and you both wonder how you'll ever get home. And I want you to read this section, talk about this this moment. It's almost as if you wish you could. I mean, it was a completely naive notion. You'll never be able to get that out, but you were.
Look, I don't want to know what I know.
Yeah.
Now I'm trying to force other people to know it. Because if I deny knowing it and other people continue to deny it, it just goes on and on. You know? Well, here, I'll read this passage. His arms are on the solid wooden table as Juarez wafts across our faces, and we do not speak of this fact. We simply inhale life and death and smell the fear of betrayal rising on the wind. I cannot explain the draw of the city that gives death but makes everyone feel life, nor can he. So we do not speak but simply note this fact with our silence. We are both trying to return to some person we imagine that we once were, the person before the killings, before the tortures, before the fear. He wants to live without the power of life and death and wonders if he can endure being without the money. I want to obliterate memory, to be in a world where I do not know of Sicarios, where I do not think of fresh corpses decorating the calles. We have followed the different paths and wound up in the same plaza, And now we sit and talk and wonder how we will ever get home. I crossed the river about 20 years ago. I can't be exact about the date, because I am still not sure what crossing really means, except that you never come back. I just know I crossed, and now I scratch like a caged animal trying to claw my way out and reach the distant shore. It is like killing. There are some things that, if learned, change a person forever. You cannot know of the slaughter running along the border and remain the same person. You cannot know of the hopeless poverty of Mexicans who are fully employed in U.S. factories and remain the same person. And you cannot listen to a sicario who functioned for years as a state policeman tell of kidnappings, tortures, and murders and remain the same person. I ask him, "Tell me about your first killing." And he says he can't remember. I know he's not telling the truth, but I know he's not lying. We all remember the first killing, the first love, the first betrayal, and the first moment we knew we would die. But sometimes you cannot reach it. You open the drawer, and your hand is paralyzed. It's right in front of you. Your nostrils fill with the smell. The gun is warm in your hand. The little quiver coming out of the throat as your hand tightens. But still you cannot reach it, and so you say you don't remember. We sit there in the quiet room, tasting the void that is now Ciudad Juarez.
Chuck, you talk about in the book how you describe in the book coming to a kind of serenity almost. I think that's the word, serenity, where things no longer make sense, but they just are. They just exist.
Yeah, you get an acceptance. I'm not endorsing it. First, you go numb. You can't actually handle all the murders, the killings. You can't handle the numbers. And then you get a kind of acceptance where you just stop worrying about things, stop trying to explain everything, and things just are. That now you're having a cup of coffee, and it tastes good. Now you get out of the chair and you walk out the door, and then you go down the street and somebody's just been murdered, and it's all just part of a routine or of a life. I think it's the only way to survive. There's over 1 million people in Juarez, and they got up today, and they went out and tried to find work and tried to find food, and every one of them knows that 22 people were executed yesterday, people just like them. But they don't try and hold that right close to their thoughts, because they'll be paralyzed, and then they won't be of any use to anyone, and they just go on. Well, I'm not any different. I just started accepting. Yeah, you get into phases of gallows humor, et cetera, but those are just to mask your feelings. The fact is you can't see this many killings. You can't see this much poverty without feeling very, very sad.
You know, you were saying before that you had survived because you were a coward, but I have to ask, do you figure eventually you're going to be killed in Juarez?
I don't know. I don't think about it. I don't care. What I know is if I hadn't gone to Juarez, if I hadn't written this book, I'd be actually dead even if I were breathing. I would have abdicated whatever I could be or contributed to the world. I would have committed a kind of suicide. That once you know, you can't ignore it. And now I got the short straw. I knew what was going on. I had the connections because I've operated in the city a long time. So I had to do it. So if I get killed, well, I get killed. You know, there's a funny thing how the human mind works, especially mine. This is no empirical basis. I'm not a religious person. But if I get into a story I think matters, I think I can't be killed until I finish it. And after I finish it, I don't care, because if you kill me, you can't stop it. I mean, that's the way my head works. Eventually, you know, we all die. I'd rather die trying to record and explain and convey the slaughter of 5,000 people than crossing a street and getting hit by a bus. So I'm not complaining. You know. Besides, this presents a kind of real deadline in my business.
Charles Bowden. He is the author of Murder City, Ciudad Juarez and the Global Economy's New Killing Field. Also the author of Dreamland, The Way Out of Juarez. Chuck, thanks very much.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. I'm Doug Fabrizio.